Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Zero Symposium on Mental Health will celebrate its 20th anniversary this year with a keynote speaker on the forefront of changing the way we treat mental illness in this country and removing the stigma surrounding these disorders. The Honorable Patrick Kennedy is a former 8-term congressman from Rhode Island who's best known as the author and lead sponsor of the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008. This legislation provides for insurers, employers, and healthcare providers to provide treatment for illnesses of the mind in the same way, in the same parity they would illnesses and injuries to the body. Although the law was enacted in 2008, the regulatory substance of the law is just now being enacted. Also during his time in Congress, Kennedy authored or co-sponsored dozens of bills concerning psychiatric disorders, PTSD, and Alzheimer's treatment. Since leaving Congress, he's been the co-founder of One Mind for Research, a coalition seeking new treatments for neurologic and psychiatric diseases, which unites a whole range of clinicians and researchers towards designing a blueprint of basic neuroscience, which will aid researchers in finding cures for these neurological disorders. He's also been an outspoken advocate of mental health parity. He'll be the keynote speaker at the Zero Symposium, which will be held this Thursday and Friday in downtown Tulsa. He'll be the speaker at the Visionaries Dinner on Thursday evening. For details on the symposium, visit MHAOK, that's Mental Health Association of Oklahoma.org. Patrick Kennedy is our guest today. Congressman Kennedy, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
You were the author of the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008, and when that passed, I think a lot of people thought that would make an immediately big difference in access to mental health treatment. But as you well know, it's taken an awful long time for the government to actually implement this act. Why has it taken so long?
Well, in fact, it was my uncle, President Kennedy, who signed the first major mental health bill, the Mental Health Act of 1963. It was the last bill he signed before he was assassinated. And it basically called for the kinds of reforms that it's taken us over 50 years to finally begin to implement. But what it illustrates is that mental health has never been a real priority in terms of following through. You know, President Kennedy said the mentally ill need no longer be alien to our affections or beyond the help of our communities. And, you know, you couldn't get a better phrase to capture the challenge we have in making sure that people with mental illness are treated like anyone else suffering from another physical illness. It's just plain discrimination and prejudice and old-fashioned bigotry that's held back the extension of health care to the mentally ill in a way that we would expect for anyone suffering any other physical health condition. And I'm sorry to say, even though I saw the bill signed into law, that it's still not a reality. And one of my charges, and I think all of our charges, because this really involves all of us, is that we need to see this law, you know, fully realized and see the spirit of taking care of one another, irrespective of where our illness occurs, to be something of a civil right for us in this country, because, you know, mental illness and brain illnesses just affect almost every family in America, whether it's a child with a developmental disability or a parent with a dementia or Parkinson's or someone, a brother and sister suffering from schizophrenia or addiction or depression. You know, this just doesn't discriminate. It's every family. And insurance companies traditionally and even the federal government have just not paid for care for brain illnesses the same way they've paid for care and even funded research for other physical illnesses.
So even though the act passed, what now, 6 years ago, there's still big disparities in access and insurance for illnesses of the mind as opposed to the body?
Yeah, there's huge disparities. And tragically, you know, we lose 40,000 Americans to suicide every year. That's just the ones we know about. Addiction and depression are epidemic. And, you know, we pay for mental illness in other ways except for the way that would be most effective. And that's to treat it early and intervene early the same way we would if someone had cancer. But if you talked about someone with mental illness and you compared them to cancer, we would be saying to people, we have to wait until you have stage 4 cancer before we treat you. That's the way we treat the mentally ill. We wait until their illness, whether it's an addiction or depression or any other mental illness, becomes really critical before we even begin to think of treating it. And that's just wrong. Not only is it wrong to the person, it just doesn't make any sense if we're really serious about treating these illnesses like any other illness.
Now, as I understand it, the regulatory system is now sort of in place, isn't it? Didn't we have some rules go into effect in July?
That's correct. This year marks really the first full year that insurance companies are required to cover illnesses of the brain in the same way they would other medical and surgical conditions. So under the law, I state 6 categories of care: inpatient, in-network, inpatient, out-of-network, outpatient, out-of-network, pharmacy benefits, and ER benefits. And if you treat a diabetic in any one of those 6 boxes, or a cancer patient, or a stroke patient, or a heart patient, then you need to treat the patient with a brain illness the same way you would a heart illness, a lung illness, or any other illness of the body. And unfortunately, we have not had the experience of treating these illnesses in the same way we do other physical illnesses. And the challenge upon us now is to begin to fill in those boxes so that people who are in need of treatment get the treatment they need.
And I suppose there are a lot of questions that surround the implementation of this law. What's the regulatory structure for making sure that insurance companies actually do fund it, that hospitals will cover that in the same way?
Well, the first thing we need to do is we need to be able to compare. But we won't be able to compare whether an insurance company, you know, imposes any higher treatment or financial limitations when considering care for someone with a brain illness, when comparing it to other physical illnesses, unless we have the data. In other words, I want to know, do they apply pre-authorization, for example, for people with heart attacks or strokes or cancer in the same way that they require pre-authorization for someone trying to see a mental health professional for treatment of depression, anxiety, addiction. And you and I both know that, of course, they impose pre-authorization in a way that they would not do for someone who has another chronic illness like asthma or cardiovascular disease or cancer or diabetes. So we can't implement the law until we know how the insurance companies are treating these illnesses differently. Even though we know they're treating them differently, we need to get to the facts. And so what I'm advocating the administration do is require full disclosure by the insurance companies on how they make their medical necessity determinations, how they employ utilization review practices, because that's where the rubber will meet the road. And if we find that insurance companies are violating the law, then we can take corrective action. But we can't hold them accountable if we don't first know, you know, the facts and are able to make the case, you know, in a persuasive way.
Well, let me ask you, is the data collection procedures in place to collect that data so we will know?
Well, we're in the process right now of asking the federal government to, you know, we don't want to be awash in data that's irrelevant. What we want to know is exactly the data that can reveal these comparative and analogous treatments. So we have to be responsible for knowing what data we want the federal government to require so we don't just get deluged with all this needless data. And that's a process that we're going through right now. But, you know, frankly, there's been several big lawsuits already under the Federal Parity Act. And there isn't practically an insurance company out there that hasn't had to be held accountable to this law, even though we still don't have, quote-unquote, all of our ducks in line. We're still getting case law every day because there's, like I said, hardly an insurance carrier out there that hasn't run afoul of the law because, you know, it's just not been their practice to pay for these illnesses in the same way they pay for other physical illnesses.
Do you believe there's like an information gap for a lot of these insurance companies, you know, going through the system, or do you think it's a sort of elemental denial of service?
Well, I think ultimately this lies with the public and the political will, because really insurance companies are just reflecting the bias that's already inherent in society against people who have these illnesses. And what we need to do is correct this. As I said, this involves everybody, not just insurance companies. If the public demanded that there be equal treatment, the insurance companies would abide by it. But, you know, we have to educate the public, not just the insurance companies. And frankly, most people don't even know about this Federal Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act because, as I said, most people never knew that it was signed into law and that it's now the law of the land. So we have some work to do to get the word out about it.
You know, earlier you said that nearly every family, and I think you're right, nearly every family or extended family has a person either with mental health issues or, say, aging issues of Alzheimer's or dementia or addiction, substance abuse problems within that family. Why do you think there's such a big disconnect between that stigma when this is something that touches nearly every family?
Well, I wish I knew the answer to that question. That's the question that's out there. If you care about, you know, your loved ones who are suffering from these illnesses, you know, you just feel a sense of shame. We assign this as a character issue to people who, quote unquote, behave badly, as opposed to a brain chemistry issue where basically the illness has taken the brain hostage and is really, and then frankly, you know, a lot of our veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan and coming out of the military now in record numbers, you know, they all go to the private employment system in addition to thinking that they can get care through the VA, which has been a challenge. But most veterans are guard and reservists. And, you know, out in Oklahoma, for example, if they work for a business, you know, we're going to have to make sure those businesses and everybody is playing on the equal playing field to make sure that these illnesses that they're often suffering from because they served us are treated the same as any other physical wound that they sustain. For example, trauma, you know, both the kind of psychological trauma of war, and also the traumatic brain injury, you know, the concussions, you know, you can't see them on the outside. But when your brain is injured, it requires the, you know, a same sense of urgency that any other organ should receive. So, you know, we have a lot of work to do, as I said. And I think most fundamental to this is trying to breach this divide of understanding. And so that people understand these as medical issues, not moral issues. As I said, chemistry issues, not character issues.
I'm glad you brought up the PTSD and TBI situation because with the wars of the last decade, and in fact, there's always been a shortage of beds for inpatient TBI, traumatic brain injuries. There's always been a shortage, but now it's even more acute because of the cases that have come back from the past decade. And it doesn't seem like there's any way the system as it exists now can keep up with the demand. What do we have to do to change that?
Well, we just have to be thoughtful and we have to follow the evidence. And the evidence shows that if you treat someone's chronic illness of the brain, you basically reduced all the other costs to their physical health care. So much of diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and the like, pain management, it so much of it stems from untreated addiction, depression, anxiety. So, you know, I think ultimately if we could get the accounting firms to really illustrate, and they're beginning to do this, that the age-old dictum, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If we really employ these early intervention methods, we would save ourselves so much money and, most importantly, so many lives and heartache that comes from untreated mental illness.
Let me ask you about one controversial fact in helping people get cared, and that is the idea of what's been called assisted outpatient treatment. This is in a situation, and it could involve a PTSD, it could involve schizophrenia or bipolar disease, where the individual is not run afoul of authorities in any way, like criminal authorities or things like that, but they don't realize it's a problem.
Yes.
And when they don't realize it's a problem, you can give them medication, but will they take it? And of course, the controversial part is getting a judicial decision or some sort of decision in which they're assisted in making those decisions to take the medication. What is your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, as I said, everything's personal. And not only am I in recovery from addiction and bipolar disorder, but, you know, my mother has suffered from it for years. And at one point, my brother and sister and I had to seek guardianship of my mother because she really was a danger to herself and others. And she was falling down. No one could find her on sidewalks. And, you know, we had to get her the care that she did not have the insight at the time to get for herself. That was a very difficult process, just legally. And as family members, we had the most at stake to take care of our mother. And this is true of other family members who care for their loved one, know their loved one better than anyone else. And so we do need to correct this. I still believe that if we intervened early in someone's illness, you know, they would not be so resistant to taking medication because if we caught the illness early, they wouldn't have to end up taking the kinds of levels of medication that they ultimately have to sometimes take because we put off care for so long. In other words, the big resistance of many people to take their medications are the side effects. But if you catch these illnesses early, you don't have to prescribe the levels of medication that produce these side effects, and therefore there wouldn't be the issues of compliance with medication that we often find because people never got the treatment early enough that was needed.
My guest today is Patrick Kennedy, the Honorable Patrick Kennedy, former 8-term congressman from Rhode Island. He's co-founder of One Mind for Research and also founder of the Kennedy Forum on Community Mental Health. He'll be the keynote speaker for the 20th Anniversary Zero Symposium on Mental Health on September 18th, and the symposium will take place the 18th and 19th. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk about one of your big areas of work, and that is reducing the number of people with severe untreated mental illness. The latest research suggests about half of the 7.8 million people with severe mental illness are untreated. That's an incredible statistic, 50%. What are the first steps in bringing that number down?
Well, you know, many of those people are in our nation's jails. They're in the state and local and county jails. It really is a tragedy of monumental proportions that we have not intervened earlier in these people's illnesses, and we wait for the criminal justice system to have to intervene. And it's inhumane, the kind of situations that these people are forced to live with now that they're locked up. And, you know, as I said, so much of this can be prevented. And I think the answer is just treat these like any other physical health issue. So, you know, I have that Irish ancestry. You know, you look at my skin, you know I'm a candidate for skin cancer. So you check for skin cancer. Why don't we have the kinds of checkups from the neck up that we expect in any other checkup that we go to when we get a doctor's appointment? So when they test your cholesterol level, it's trying to save you from a stroke or a heart attack, you know, 20, 30 years in advance. We ought to be employing the same sense of urgency to prevent illnesses that we do with every other illness. Diabetes, they wouldn't have to wait until they had to cut your legs off because you're untreated diabetes or you went blind. And yet that's exactly what they do with the mentally ill. They wait until it's like a crisis before they treat it. And so what I really think we need is is not like one solution. We just need a different attitude. We need to treat these illnesses like any other physical illness.
Are you talking about evaluations as a part of the physical, or are you talking about looking at case histories and then deciding whether evaluations are part of the treatment?
The exciting thing about the time we're living in is we're advancing so much in the area of personalized medicine. That means that we can marry both the genetic, person's genetic makeup and the tests that we can do on that with their family history. So in my family, we've had, many generations of people suffer from severe alcoholism on my mother's side and on my father's side. And frankly, the notion that a doctor who sees me would not take that into account in doing a workup on me, in other words, asking me if I were a teenager, how much I was abusing, drugs, and that would not be part of the, conversation. It's just startling that, those kinds of conversations do not take place in pediatrician's office, but even in geriatrician's office, because frankly, senior citizens are suffering a great deal from addiction and depression. Many seniors, their depression is confused for dementia, and so these things are epidemic across the age spectrum.
But there you get back to the stigma, where as a doctor is going to ask you about, how much red meat you eat, how much alcohol you consume. Those other questions, it crosses into that stigma area where both doctor and patient are somewhat uncomfortable in asking and answering those questions.
That's right. That's why I say this issue really requires all of us. Okay, so I talked about the insurance companies need to be educated, the public, the medical community needs to be educated. We all need to take a different, look at this and reframe our view of it in the same way that we look at other physical health issues. Because, frankly, this is the area where we can make the greatest inroads in the next couple of decades in reducing the cost of health care. If we just treated these illnesses more effectively, as I said earlier on, we'd save ourselves untold heartache and of course, huge dollars that often go to, caring for people or picking up the pieces after they've fallen apart.
I want to ask you, you mentioned the police effect and unfortunately how they have to treat a lot of severe untreated mental illness, and it's through incarceration most of the time. But, the other side of that was when people need acute care and inpatient care, there's a horrible lack of a number of psychiatric beds in the country. It's well known. Most of the states tend to incarcerate people with mental illness rather than treating them. And I think the standards are about 50 beds per 100,000. I don't think there's a state in the country that actually meets that. There's a couple that come close. Oklahoma, for example, has 11 beds per 100,000. So do we have to see the states invest in more psychiatric beds?
I believe states would invest in more psychiatric beds if they did a real audit of what the costs are for not treating those people. So if they did an audit of how much they spend on housing and law enforcement and corrections and social services and all of these other budgets that aren't ascribed as mental health budgets, but really reflect when you're trying to pick up the pieces, as I said, of someone after they've fallen apart. I think it just makes sense for states to invest in prevention. Now, there's some folks who are going to have acute and persistent mental illness, and they ought to be treated like any other acute and persistent illness that we have. So we have those kinds of beds for stroke victims, for heart attack victims, for others, cancer victims, and we ought to be able to treat these illnesses in the same way. So I think that, first and foremost, the federal government, in addition to the insurance companies, needs to reimburse in the same way they would other physical health conditions, or else we're going to continue to see this huge disparity in the needed beds against the demand for care.
And it sounds like you advocate a whole spectrum from the acute inpatient to the acute outpatient to just a whole level of standard of care.
Well, we need standards of care in this area. And, of course, it's almost the Wild West now in terms of, you know, how we treat these illnesses most effectively. But I think we're learning so much now. We have new tools to understand how the brain works and how these illnesses manifest themselves and what are the best courses of treatment and care. And what we need to begin doing is paying for what we know works. Often people are wasting their dollars, taking out second mortgages on their homes to pay for care. And oftentimes that care is substandard because we're not holding facilities and treatment professionals to the same standards we hold or expect from other medical professions. So this is something we need to do across the board. And as I said, it's more of a cultural change that revolves around all of us changing our attitudes towards these illnesses.
And I assume that's one of the big areas of emphasis for your One Mind for Research, which is basically collating all the research that is going on so that it is readily available, best practices, latest insights into treatment of substance abuse or mental health issues.
We need to go to inner space. So President Kennedy, you know, called on us to go to outer space. I can't imagine any mission more important to understanding quality of life for all of us than to understand how the most important organ in our body functions. And we can put ourselves to this test and we can reach this if we do it just in the same way that we reach the moon. It's going to take concerted action. And it's going to take political will, and it needs to be on the order of like our national security issues, because that's the only way to put the kind of effort behind this that we need. And when we understand how the brain works, we're going to help avert the kind of epidemic of depression and addiction and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS and all of these illnesses, developmental disabilities, autism. Frankly, it's all the brain. And you can't segment the brain out and just say, oh, this part of the brain is, you know, affects autism and this part, you know, Alzheimer's and this part addiction. We've got to do this together, because in the course, just like going to outer space, of finding where we want to go, we're going to discover all kinds of other answers to other brain illnesses along the way.
You're an important advocate for community mental health, and we look forward to your appearance at the Zero Symposium. Patrick Kennedy, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome. I look forward to being there.
Mental health activist and former 8-term congressman from Rhode Island, Patrick Kennedy, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the co-founder of One Mind for Research, as well as the Kennedy Forum on Community Mental Health. He'll be the keynote speaker for the 20th anniversary Zero Symposium on Mental Health, which will take place this Thursday and Friday. He'll be speaking Thursday evening at the Visionaries Dinner. For more information on the symposium and the dinner, visit the Mental Health Association of Oklahoma at mhaok.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.